More than 1 million people turned out in Chicago yesterday for the annual Pride Parade.
My name is Monique, and Chicago Pride means love to me.
One word I think about as I celebrate Pride 2016 is family.
Those are a few parade goers talking to the Chicago Tribune. Today, we'll talk with Lambda Legal's Jim Bennett about this moment in LGBTQ history. Also, the end of the fiscal year is Thursday. What happens to the many agencies, social service groups, and others without a state budget? Governor Rauner's holding a press conference as we speak, urging lawmakers to pass his stopgap measure. And a new study from Northwestern University is one of the first to look at depression before and during pregnancy. We'll learn more from the psychologist who did the research. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I hope everyone enjoyed their weekends. You know, it's been a year since the Supreme Court ruled that same-sex couples can marry in every state. It was a landmark decision that came after decades of legal and political battles. It was also a moment of reflection for many, especially in the LGBTQ community, about what led to the ruling, the expected backlash, and what comes next. There's been so many moments since, including the mass shooting in Orlando 2 weeks ago at a gay nightclub. And then yesterday, on the anniversary of the marriage ruling, the Pride Parade kicked off in Chicago with a renewed sense of reflection and celebration. Jim Bennett was there for the parade. He's the Midwest Regional Director for the nonprofit advocacy group Lambda Legal, and he joins us on the phone from Chicago. Jim, thanks for coming on the 21st.
Thanks, and happy Pride.
Thanks, Jim. So I read there were at least a million people at the parade yesterday, but it started with a moment of silence and a display for the 49 victims of the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando. What was the tone like for this year's parade?
It was a very celebratory parade, although it definitely started off on a more somber tone, and you did feel it throughout the parade. The organizers had 49 giant pictures. I was almost like 4 feet tall of each one of the victims of the Orlando shooting, and they were beautiful color pictures, sort of at the height of their life. And so it was numbing to see that, but it was nice. And then the parade got started. So we had a moment of silence, and then got going. It was a joyous, shockingly not rainy day.
Well, coming so soon after the shooting, I think people in Chicago always describe the Pride Parade as kind of the one parade in Chicago that's definitely a real family-friendly event where lots of people come and bring their families. Did you find that more people were there and wanted to make a statement?
It's interesting. The crowd did not feel as big to me, although it's very hard to measure when you're in the parade.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I definitely believe that there were more people from our community, from the LGBT community, that came. I have a lot of friends. I'm older, and so I have friends that sort of like, oh, you know, I'm done with Pride, or they want to sit on the sidelines and watch.
It's a long walk.
It is a long walk, or you know, I'm over it. And not this year. Like there was a real sense like I needed, and I felt it too. Like I need to be in this parade, and I need to be visible. And you know, the roots of the Pride Parade, of course, were founded in protest and making sure that we're not invisible. And that to me was the most prevalent feeling throughout the day. We had volunteers in their 70s that had not joined us in probably 10, 15 years, and they wanted to march alongside of us. And so it was really beautiful, a really, really beautiful day.
You know, Jim, as you say that and you're talking about the roots of the movement, I'm thinking about President Obama's announcement on Friday about Stonewall, making that a national monument. And I wonder what the monument means to you and if people were talking about that yesterday.
It's interesting. Like, I think for our entire community, and that's why the Pulse tragedy was so powerful for us, was bars for us, in many ways, is like our church. You know, it's the first place you could go where you could be completely who you are. You weren't, you know, as a guy, like I wouldn't be afraid to look at another guy and risk getting beaten up. And you felt like you were safe and you could be yourself. And our movement began in Stonewall, which is this, you know, a bar in New York that, as legend goes, that Judy Garland had passed, and the police were constantly raiding this bar, and it was gays and drag queens and trans people and everyone in that bar that just decided they weren't going to take it anymore, and it began days of riots, and that's the origin of our movement, or our modern movement at least. And so to have it declared as a national monument is extraordinary. And so much of our history, the LGBT history, is erased, where we don't know who our heroes throughout time, that if they were LGBT or not. And so to have history recorded finally for us, and to have this recognition by a president and an administration who have stood with our community like no other before, it's incredible. I mean, it's absolutely fantastic.
Well, when you talk about President Obama and the administration, we have to talk about what happened a year ago with the Supreme Court and the ruling a year ago. And I wonder how you think that moment, it was a year ago yesterday that the Supreme Court said same-sex marriages should be legal throughout the entire country. How do you think that changed the conversation around everything we've been talking about, not just history, but around LGBT rights?
Well, that was a Lambda Legal case. That was one of our cases, so we were very excited, to say the least, along with ACLU and many other groups. But the fight for marriage was a long time coming, and it really played out state by state in Illinois. We did it through the Illinois Assembly, and to be.
It was 2.5 years ago. I remember talking to you the day after that happened. Do you remember that? We were at Sidetrack talking about that.
Of course. Of course. And our bar, our community center. The ability to marry the person you love, and for that to be named a fundamental right, is absolutely earth-shattering in terms of our movement and our ability to move forward. And it's had I believe part of it is so many people were involved in that fight, not just LGBT people, but our families and friends and allies, that as you got to know us and you realized that we were looking for the same responsibility and the ability to take care of our family that that everyone wants. And so one to win that was incredible, and we knew there would be a backlash. I mean, we always know that when there's strides, whether it's on one side of the spectrum or the other, there's always a swing of the pendulum back. So we expected to see some of the fights. First we saw in Indiana where religion is used as a tool to discriminate and try to enshrine in law the ability to discriminate against, making marriage, people don't have to serve cakes or don't have to take pictures at the weddings, but more importantly, things like hospitals and can a hospital refuse service to a same-sex partner? And then what are the links to that in other communities? If you can refuse one group on your personally held religious beliefs, can you deny women contraception, or can you deny HIV meds, or can you deny medication to trans people? So that's the backlash we've seen in Indiana and North Carolina, where Lambda Legal suing the state, Mississippi, and ultimately we saw 200 of these bills of legislators sort of trying to put discrimination into their laws.
Well, Jim, there's backlash, but then there's also the violence, and we have the horrific shooting in Orlando, 49 people killed in a gay nightclub. I don't imagine that's something you would have ever anticipated. And I wonder how you think the past few weeks, how that's changed your work.
I believe they're linked. I believe that when you create an environment where politicians are telling our kids that they can't use the bathroom that fits their gender, or when states don't want LGBT people in their state, you create an environment for people that are unstable to a license in their mind to discriminate. And so I think anytime words have power, and so when we see our politicians and our government using these type of things, it's harmful. The Orlando shooting as hard as last year was, it was nothing compared to going through that. To see 49 young people and the stories many of us have read, the mother who jumped in the way to protect her son and lost her life in the process. It was the most tragic thing I've ever witnessed in our community. But I believe it galvanizes us. It's a recognition that it was our identity and LGBT community that was targeted. You cannot help but recognize the problem we have with gun violence in this country. And I believe, time will tell, but I really believe the LGBT community is going to forcefully join that fight.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Are you seeing that? Because I think we've seen, do you think that this will become another issue that the community will take up? Is this something Lambda Legal is thinking about getting involved with?
I can say we have signed on to a statement that almost every LGBT group has in joining the fight. I think we're still trying to figure out our way on how we join that fight. Interesting to me, like in the parade, to be in the parade, you're going by all these beautiful crowds of people, and I've never seen so many signs that were handmade for gun control, and for new legislation around guns, and it was throughout the ride or throughout the walk, and it was organic. I mean, there were people that just felt this need to have this up, and I do believe that has to be our cause. My opinion is that we should work with the groups that are already on the ground doing it. I don't know if the LGBT community has any specific ability to fight it alone, but it should be our fight. You know, there was a time at the vigil, the Monday after the massacre in Orlando, and we were at the center on Halsted, which is the gay community center here in Chicago. And one of the women who spoke had said that 13 times that the President Obama has called us to this fight and has said to us, this is everyone's fight, the people must take it on. And then she went through and said, the first time I ignored it because immigration was my issue, and the second time I ignored it because I'm an artist and I was focusing on the arts. And then she said when this tragedy happened, she recognized that each one of those times the president was calling all of us, and it included her, and it includes all of us. So I certainly, for myself and living in Chicago, where gun violence becomes horrifically routine, that it's something that I intend to fight on the side of gun control for the rest of my life, or at least until it's addressed, and I have every expectation that our community will do the same.
That's Jim Bennett. He's the Midwest Regional Director for Lambda Legal. Thanks so much, Jim, for taking the time to talk with us.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When we think of pregnancy and depression, we tend to think of it happening after women give birth. But a new study from Northwestern University shows that about one-third of women suffer depression while pregnant. And if it's not treated early, the symptoms can be much more severe and longer lasting. In a few minutes, we're going to be speaking to the psychologist who did that research. But first, we wanted to talk to one mother who's experienced this firsthand. Her name's Molly Shawl. She's a mother of two and a blogger from Kansas City and joins us now on the line. Hi, Molly. Welcome to the 21st. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, it's a pleasure.
So, Molly, I wonder if you can tell us about your bout of depression, because it came during your second pregnancy, and how was it different from your first?
Well, with my first, the pregnancy was planned, and I was very happy, very bubbly, very much looking forward to becoming a mother, and I didn't really have any feelings of depression during that pregnancy. When I got pregnant the second time, it was a big surprise. And so at first there were, of course, feelings of nervousness and, oh my gosh, can I do this again? My first son was only 12 months. So it was, they were going to be really close together, and I was going to be a mother of two under the age of two. So that made me a little bit nervous, but I thought that was probably normal. as the pregnancy progressed, I still was having those feelings of, I'm just not very excited about this.
This is for your second child.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I wasn't feeling happy. I wasn't feeling, I wasn't looking forward to having another baby. And eventually, I was in my second trimester and just feeling terrible mentally, just feeling like I didn't even want to get out of bed. And I knew that that wasn't right. And so that's when I went to my OB.
What did your OB say?
Well, I'm very lucky and blessed in the fact that she listened to me and she did not dismiss my feelings. I went to her to say, I think something's going on. I, you know, didn't expect to feel this way. I didn't expect to feel depressed during pregnancy, but I am feeling depressed and it's been very difficult to function. She was wonderful and told me that I'm not the first patient that that she had seen deal with perinatal depression. And she recommended a low dose of Zoloft for me, which I was very nervous about because, you know, my first feelings were, is this going to hurt the baby?
Yeah.
But
Molly, can I stop you for
a
second there? Because
sure.
We're going to have to take a break, but I want to pick up this conversation. We just need to take a short break. But we're speaking with Molly Shawls. We're talking to her about the depression that she experienced during one of her pregnancies. It's all based on there's some new research about this from Northwestern University. We're going to be continuing this conversation in just a few minutes. Stay tuned to the 21st.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, fostering knowledge in its disciplines by recruiting and retaining library faculty, researchers, and thought leaders with deep subject matter knowledge and expert librarianship. The University Library at Illinois.
Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about pregnancy and depression, not just postpartum, but also perinatal. It's all part of some new research that Northwestern University has just published. We're going to be speaking to that author in just a moment, but in the minute, right now, we're talking to a blogger. She blogs at mollybecky.com. Her name is Molly Shawls. She's a mom from Kansas City. And Molly, just before the break, you were telling us that you felt like it was fortunate that you had a doctor who, when you went to that doctor during your second pregnancy, said, you're not the first person that's come to me with this and put you on a very low dose of medication. I imagine you were probably really concerned about the medication and the pregnancy, right?
I was. My first thought was, how is this going to affect, you know, my baby? But she reassured me that she had seen great results with some of her other patients. And so I trusted her. She also recommended therapy, weekly therapy. So I knew that in conjunction with the medicine that it was a hopeful prognosis that I would be able to make my way back to being happy about the pregnancy and looking forward to holding that new baby. And she was right.
So were you able to do that? In a month?
Yes. But yeah, within about a month. I wasn't 100%, but I could definitely tell a difference that I was feeling more hopeful. I was feeling like I could function, whereas beforehand, it was very difficult for me to even want to get out of bed. So I had all of those symptoms of depression where you don't want to get out of bed, you don't want to shower, you don't want to eat. Those are all things that are dangerous when you're pregnant. And so I think it's so important to seek help if you're feeling like that.
Did you have postpartum depression?
I did not. By the time I had my second baby, I did not struggle with postpartum depression or postpartum anxiety. And I I stayed on, but the recommendation was that I stay on Zoloft even after the baby came, and I did. I stayed on Zoloft through, you know, the birth, and then I think it was about 6 months after the baby came. So I think that that also helped with helped postpartum depression stay away.
Molly, how are you and your kids doing now?
Oh, we're doing great. Having my second baby was very, it was fulfilling in that it, you know, my first birth had been, and I don't think I mentioned this, but it was a traumatic birth where, my first son came out not breathing. And so the second birth was very healing for me in that it was, there were no complications. And so we were able to just become that family of four and enjoy the time with the new baby. And we have just come to love our family.
So I should clarify, for your first son came out not breathing, but then he was okay afterwards. He was able
yes,
to, yeah.
He was, right. They whisked him away to the NICU and they were able to get him breathing. But that was very traumatic for me and for us, just not knowing what had happened to him. And so I think that was a little bit of the nervousness that came with my second pregnancy was I was not looking forward to the birth because I was a little bit scared and frightened.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
It would happen again.
Molly, why do you think it's so important to talk about this publicly?
I think that just like depression, when you're not pregnant or when you've not just had a baby, there's a stigma. There's a stigma against it. Everyone thinks that you should be a happy, bubbly person when you're pregnant, and it's supposed to be the, you know, most glorious time of your life, looking forward to that baby. And I think that some mothers are probably scared to talk about it and scared to approach their doctor and tell them. That's why it's so important for mothers who have experienced this to speak out and say, this does happen. Sometimes pregnancy isn't fun, and sometimes you get depressed when you're pregnant, and that's okay. And that's why it's so important to talk about it, because I think that some moms feel that they can't. Mm. And so if you talk about it and you inform people that this is something that happens, then they won't be scared to approach their doctor and say, hey, I'm having trouble with this pregnancy.
That's Kansas City mom, Molly Schalls. I wanted to bring someone else into the conversation. The reason we're having this conversation is because of a new study that was just published in the Journal of Affective Disorders. Sheehan Fisher is the study's lead author. He teaches psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine and joins us on the phone right now from Chicago. Welcome to the 21st, Professor Fisher.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate you inviting me.
Now, your study is one of the first to look at this entire timeline of women before, during, and after pregnancy. As we're listening to Molly's story, I wonder how common that is and what you found out about how many people tend to face, how many women tend to face depression and at what point during their pregnancy.
Yeah, so her story is quite common. I appreciate her sharing that. So what we found, we're looking at depression that was identified in the postpartum. What we're trying to show is that even though it's identified in the postpartum, it doesn't necessarily make it quantify as postpartum depression, that the onset could have started prior to that time point. So it could have started in the prenatal period, or it could have started prior to even getting pregnant. And that has implications for the type of depression and experience of it during the postpartum period. And so what we found was that depression that started earlier had a higher severity during that postpartum time, and that helped to differentiate by different factors of what predicted whether the mother would have an onset in the postpartum, prenatally, or in the pre-pregnancy period.
So when you found that one-third of women deal with depression during pregnancy, was that a surprise to you?
It was not a surprise because I also see mothers during the perinatal period for my clinical work. And so we prefer that mothers come in early, like Molly mentioned, and that we can get an opportunity to help them deal with the depression early that hopefully will prevent there being a depression in the postpartum period. So the earlier that we can identify and treat the mother, the better.
I know that several states, including in Illinois, I know New Jersey and West Virginia and Washington, have mandatory screening for perinatal depression. Is that something that you feel like doctors everywhere need to be checking in, OBGYNs need to be checking in with their patients on at the beginning of pregnancy?
I think that it would be very essential to start to make it more nationwide. I think that the fact is the higher rates of depression during this time for mothers, and therefore a lot of times they're not identified until they have an episode in the postpartum through these screenings. And if we can make it more broad, a lot more mothers can get the services that they need, get there early, and then hopefully help them to prevent long-term depression, but then even more has benefit for child outcomes long-term.
You know, why is it important to make that diagnosis so early, even before pregnancy?
Well, even sometimes for our clinic, we do prenatal counseling also, so that if a mother has a history of depression, we can be a little more proactive to hopefully prevent the onset of the depression. The goal is to prevent it from even starting in the first place, so the earlier we can work with the mother, the better. But then if it has already started, like I said, you know, early treatment can help prevent some of the long-lasting outcomes.
Professor Fisher, do we know if women who have a history of depression prior to pregnancy, does that correlate to having depression during pregnancy or afterwards?
Yeah, so history of depression is the highest predictor of onset of depression during the perinatal period. So just having that history in general puts the mother at risk. And then other factors like was mentioned, such as having multiple children, having less resources, other things that it doesn't mean that it causes, but just it's associated with a higher risk of developing perinatal depression.
So Molly told us she went to her doctor and she essentially went to her doctor and shared. What would you suggest? And she was very helpful. Molly, thanks for mentioning all of those signs and being very clear about what you experienced. I wonder, Professor Fisher, if you could explain a little bit more about signs, warning signs, and what people need to be maybe to encourage other women who may be experiencing this so they can kind of have a sense of what might be going on.
So if they are starting to feel sadness, and especially if it seems to be prolonged, lasting even a couple weeks or longer, but also lack of pleasure in things you usually enjoy. So that could be food, watching TV, or enjoying your friends where you don't feel that same level of enjoyment, along with other symptoms like fatigue or feeling loss of appetite, feelings of worthlessness or excessive guilt, difficulty concentrating. Symptoms that like that can go along with the symptoms of depression, and that cluster of symptoms might be indicative of a depressive episode.
Molly, was it hard for you to sort of, I imagine there's so much pressure on, you're already a mom, especially during you had a one-year-old. I mean, that's a lot of pressure to begin with. You're not sleeping very well. There's a lot going
right.
on. I mean, I wonder what it was that made you realize I need to talk to someone to get some help.
It was knowing that I didn't really get out of bed for the day for me. I was doing it because I had to, because I did have a son that needed to be taken care of. But I knew that if I didn't have him, I would have just been laying in bed and I wouldn't have gotten up. And so that definitely told me, okay, I need to admit that something is really wrong. And that's when I went to the doctor and told her I don't have any desire to, you know, live my life like I used to. And I think that concerned her. And I think she made the right decisions for me.
Professor Fisher, what are the options for newer expectant moms when it comes to medication and other treatments for depression?
Well, there is medication that's proven to be effective and safe during pregnancy and the postpartum. SSRIs are a lot of times the first wave of treatment. And so it's pretty important for mothers to address any concerns they might have about the effects on the fetus or even during the postpartum for breastfeeding, just to talk to their provider about that and have a conversation about their concerns. And then also thinking about psychotherapy treatments that can also be effective for helping to deal with the depression. A lot of things that go along with not just the hormonal changes and other biological changes, but also just, as I mentioned, like the stigma and other factors that can play into it that they need to be able to work through. And sometimes they're feeling guilty about feeling depressed during this time, supposed to be a happy mother, things like that that come up that need to be addressed and help the mother to reorganize her cognitions around some of these experiences and then also change her behaviors to be involved in the things that make her a happy person.
Professor Fisher, with the information from this study, what do you think should happen next?
Well, next, first is just for clinicians to think broadly and do a more in-depth assessment of the depression to see what the chronicity of that depression is. But then, as I mentioned a little earlier, screening just nationwide, getting more involved with screening and having access to referrals. And then just more people who specialize in perinatal mental health so that the specialists can provide that type of specialty care for these mothers.
Do both of you, and I have a question for both of you, do you think things have changed for the better in this area in recent years? Do you think there is, as you're talking so much about mental health, is about overcoming the stigma? Molly, do you think that things are better?
I think there has been a huge push for talking about mental illness. And that's one of the things I talk about on my blog, because I think that it deserves airtime. It deserves to be talked about and for this stigma to kind of be squashed, because there are a lot of people out there that are scared to admit that they have, these issues, and they need help. And it's important for us to talk about that. One of the websites is Postpartum Progress, and they talk specifically about perinatal mood disorders and postpartum depression. And that website, if you Google postpartum depression, it pops up, and it is a huge help to women that are seeking information on what might be going on with them.
Professor Fisher, are there resources for women or families, other ones that you think people should know about?
So I think, there is a lot of information that she just mentioned. I think that in general, the Marseille Society has put out information about postpartum depression, and there's obviously more research articles, but even in academia, we're moving toward trying to write more information in just, public media, just to address some of these concerns so people are more educated about it, hopefully to reduce the stigma and make it more universal, just understanding that about 16% of women are going to go through this experience, and therefore try to normalize it to the point that people can talk about it and feel free to talk to their families and providers. Even recently, I published an article in OI Los Angeles about writing it in Spanish to reach other populations.
Professor Fisher, can you remind me again? I'm sorry, did you say what percentage of women you think will experience this?
Well, about 16% of women.
16%?
16, yeah.
Okay. Thanks for that. So that's the study's lead author. It's in the Journal of Affective Disorders. She and Fisher teaches psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Northwestern's Feinberg School of Medicine on that study. I want to thank also Molly Schalls joining us from Kansas City. She's a blogger. She's at mollybecky.com. We've tweeted out the links to her blog as well as resources if you need help, especially if you're suffering from depression. That's all going to be up at www.21stshow.org. And it's at 21st on Twitter as well. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining me.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, in the past hour, Governor Rauner has held a news conference in Springfield. He's been joined by several mayors, and he's urging lawmakers to pass funding that would be a stopgap measure in the absence of any other state budget.
This would be just an outrageous tragic failure for the people of Illinois. We cannot allow this to happen. That's the reason I applaud Leader Redonio and Leader Redurkin for stepping up and introducing two bills to get us through this crisis. They've introduced a stopgap budget. It's not a long-term solution, but it allows for the appropriation of key funds from existing accounts. The money is there. We raise over $32 billion a year. The money is there to provide essential services on a continuing basis for public safety, for construction, for human services.
That's Governor Rauner less than an hour ago in Springfield. Coming up, as the 21st continues, we're going to be talking to Amanda Vinicky. She's fresh from that news conference. We're also going to be joined by Matt Dietrich. He's the editor of Reboot Illinois, and we're going to be talking about this very important week ahead in politics for the state and the budget. Stay tuned to the 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Listening to the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're days away from the end of the fiscal year for the state of Illinois. That's turning into a deadline many say they won't be able to survive past. The United Way is estimating that more than 1 million people in Illinois have lost services because of lawmakers' inability to pass a budget. IDOT is warning road construction projects will be halted. Even Illinois lottery winners may not get payouts. That's all this Friday if nothing happens. Each day on the 21st, as we lead up to that Thursday deadline, we're going to be talking to different people across the state who have been affected by the budget. Today, we thought we'd start by setting the scene for you with some background and analysis, as we do every Monday when we discuss Illinois politics with reporters throughout the state. Today, we're sticking in Springfield, specifically in the State House, with Amanda Vinicky. She's Illinois Public Radio State House Bureau Chief and joins us fresh from the news conference that Governor Rauner has just been holding. Hey, Amanda.
Hi there, Nyla.
Also with us from Springfield, the editor of Reboot Illinois, Matt Dietrich, is also on the line. Hey, Matt, thanks for being here as well.
Thanks, Nyla.
Amanda, can you just give us a summary of, we played a little bit of what Governor Rauner was saying in the past hour about getting, how important it was to have this stopgap measure funding. What else did he say?
You know, he really reiterated that claim. It's one that he's been making since the end of May, and I always do like to point out it is a role reversal for him. He had previously been opposed to the notion of anything temporary, wanting a focus on a grand bargain, quote unquote. So perhaps by turning the focus to a stopgap, there's a couple of takeaways. Number one, that the government really has gotten to the end of the line in terms of stretching the dollars and making it through without any actual budget. So I mean, a sign there, and also perhaps a strategic sign of he does not want to be the governor that wears the jacket for any sort of fallout and outcome, and further, that it may be a sign that he's not going hopeful about any grand bargain being achieved anytime soon. He says that it'll be Democrats that are trying to wait until after the elections in November, but it might be Rauner himself that also at least sees that as a time frame. So really what he said is we've been reporting that it will be a shutdown of any road construction projects, that it could be a crisis for schools as August and the time for the end of summer break nears, if there is not any budget authority that is, if there isn't any sort of spending authority. Keep in mind that Democrats do have supermajorities. They couldn't agree on a budget. So right now there's nothing for him to sign, unlike last year when he vetoed the budget that Democrats set them. So he's asking also for the Democratic leaders as well as the Republican minority leaders of the General Assembly to meet with him tomorrow, one day ahead of the Wednesday session when the House and Senate will
Right, and I heard him say, Amanda, I heard him say, right, he said, I'll go to Chicago if they need me to, we'll do mm-hmm. anything. Matt, here's my question to you. Are we close to, before we even get to the budget and everything, like Democrats passing an actual budget as well as all of the effects that Amanda was just laying out, are we at all close to a deal on this stopgap funding? Matt, what's the sense in Springfield?
It's not sounding that way. It doesn't sound like either side is... if you listen to the governor's version, it's that the Democrats are dead set against any that they're convinced they want a Chicago, as he calls it, bailout. The governor, he spoke a lot about this in his press conference today, is very much opposed to giving more money to Chicago schools. So it seems like that's become the one point where they've really locked horns. And you know, and like Amanda was saying, and we're reaching a point now where if they don't get something done by the end of the day Thursday, you're going to see really visible effects immediately. And I think one of the biggest things you're going to see, if you've driven on Illinois highways recently, all that construction that's going on right now is going to stop, because the budget authority for the capital projects that are funded the construction that you're seeing, those end. Those only are covered through the fiscal year that ends June 30th. So if they don't get something done on the capital front, you'll see all those projects stop possibly. The school issue is a huge problem. And,
let's start with the roads first, because as we're starting to think about all of these things, and thanks for that point about IDOT. I think, Amanda, we're looking at what, some $2 billion in road construction projects that will be shut down on July 1st without a state budget agreement. How much is this halt in road construction? I imagine that's going to add up to costs later on if it gets stopped and then started.
Yeah. I mean, that's really the point. I just drove from Chicago to Springfield this morning, and let me tell you, I didn't run into too much construction, but there's a stretch where it slows you down, and any driver might be saying, hooray, wait, I hate all that road construction.
But well, they're not going to move the lanes. Problem. You're still going to be stuck in one lane, first
yeah,
of all. I feel like I should point out to everybody.
Right. I mean, you're basically just going to have it at a standstill, and then that costs more money down the literal and metaphorical road, because you are having instead crews repairing the roads, having to cover them up and have things kind of on hold for however long that takes, then the projects will get worse. And already Illinois has a big backlog of deferred maintenance. And the governor has long called, he wants more money to be put into construction and repairs beyond just roads and bridges.
Well, I think, let me ask you guys, isn't a lot of that money federal money? I think people might be scratching their heads thinking, isn't this federal money that's coming through IDOT, isn't it just kind of pass-through money? Why would it have to stop now?
Well, it still needs to be appropriated. You still need to have the legislative authority. And a lot of that is federal money, but it has to be matched by a state contribution. So who knows? Down the road, we've already heard some issues with that. And that is why in one of the many piecemeal spending bills that was passed throughout this past year, when we say despite having no budget, money is still going out, and that is because there were minor agreements, that authority also expires June 30th. So the state match wouldn't be going forward. Right now, it appears that the federal government has been fairly patient, understanding politics, and, of course, stands so because DCU's had its share of that. And nonetheless, could there be even more jeopardy down the line, especially as if Illinois does go a second year, or who knows how long this second standoff could continue.
Right, and this has been and in the past we've had, I can remember Senator Durbin being kind of angry about Illinois dawdling over getting its transportation bill done because it missed out on federal money by not having a plan. And the other thing, Nyla, too, and I'm with Amanda because I drive back and forth from Chicago quite a bit. Hey, I'd love to see that construction stop because it drives me crazy. But think about this. If those things stop, you're looking at missing an entire season of road construction. You're going to pay for that down the road in time that traffic is backed up.
Well, and also think about winter. We have no idea what winter's going to be like for roads. There's a lot of work that has
jobs,
to be done.
Construction jobs. Actually, that's another.
Well, let's talk about jobs. Let's talk about lost services, because there was a United Way survey out suggesting that about 1 million people throughout the state have lost services as a result of the failure to pass a budget. Matt, what's the sense of social service groups? And we've heard, I mean, we've had people coming on the 21st talking about this program is going to shut as of June 30th. How many other programs are there that maybe at a last gasp were kind of managing to hold out and now will not be able to after Thursday?
Well, I don't have an exact count, but I know that every day you see more announcements on these kind of things. There was just I saw something on one of the social service agencies in the Metro East is getting ready to close down. Now, the one recourse that some of these groups have is they can go to court and they can say the state is not paying their contract, and they can get a court order that forces the state to pay. That's how a lot of these groups have managed to limp along through the year, and you do have a lawsuit that's going on right now with a bunch of these social service agencies, and one of the plaintiffs is actually the Ounce of Prevention Fund, whose chairperson is First Lady Diana Rauner. The social service agencies have, some of them can go to court and get court orders and be covered. Some of them can't, and it also doesn't cover their entire budgets. So you see them cutting staff, cutting programs. Some are going out of business, and when they go away, they're not going to come back.
Matt, we were talking about schools earlier, and Amanda, as you said, we had funding for K through 12 because of special legislation that was passed this year. That appropriation also ends on Thursday, right, Amanda?
Yeah, exactly. So in some cases, there really is a hard and fast deadline. In other cases, as with, you know, social services, there are some that are going to last. It's just the uncertainty after having gone a full year without a budget. How much longer do they go? It's every passing day. With schools, obviously, most schools don't open July 1. There are a couple of year-round schools where that's an exception. But for the most part, they have until August, September. So expect if there isn't a sort of settlement by July 1st that this will be something that legislators return to Springfield and is a continued issue. But again, of course, we all know you want to plan. Schools need to know what if they need to make their own contingency plans, and it's just really a level of uncertainty that I think is the uncertainty, maybe not strong enough a word. You have parents concerned, maybe working parents, where are they going to send their kids? You think about violence in the city of Chicago that occurs more during the summer when already we've seen without, you know, teen reach programs or after school programs, where are kids going to go? And obviously any sort of lost learning that comes from it. So that's where you had Governor Rauner this morning saying that it is his top priority. He will do everything he can, he says, to make sure schools open on time. And yet, in the same time, says that he will not stand by anything that gives Chicago public schools any extra. And this comes as Democrats are calling for, they're not phrasing it that way per se. They do say that CPS gets a raw deal because of how Illinois provides for teachers' pensions. And further, they want a revamp of the overall funding formula and have called for more money. It's again, kind of one of those interesting anomalies. You have Governor Rauner saying, last year, Democrats didn't put as much money as I wanted to into schools. This year, instead, it's the governor saying that he wants to put more money, yes, into schools than
except
last
for
year,
Chicago schools,
but not as much as Democrats want to put in.
Right.
They're looking for more for Chicago, but also other schools. It's nonetheless what he terms a bailout.
Amanda, you mentioned pensions. I wanted to ask you, let's shift. We have just a couple minutes left here, and I just wanted to shift the focus away from kind of what the effects are and then what people are saying about how we should solve this problem. And one of those solutions is, as you mentioned, pensions. I'm thinking about an editorial that was in the Northwest Herald talking about the McHenry County Board quietly voting to end pensions for themselves and saying, this editorial saying, Illinois should, lawmakers should be ending their pensions, and the fact that they're socking away retirement savings while they haven't been able to pass a budget for a year is, quote, nauseating. Matt, I wanted to just ask you about what's happening in McHenry County and if we have a sense that maybe other municipalities may follow this lead.
Well, what happened in McHenry County was you had State Representative Jack Franks who brought up the fact that by state law, members of the county board, members of municipal governments across the state, to be eligible for a pension under the Illinois Municipal Retirement Fund, they're supposed to be putting in 1,000 hours a year. And Jack Franks brought up, hey, I don't think anybody on the McHenry County Board is putting in 1,000 hours per year. And most of them didn't even know of the existence of this 1,000-hour requirement. And down here in Springfield, the same thing happened with the Sangamon County Board once this came up and people started asking questions. Well, are you guys working 1,000 hours a week? And, you know, they don't keep track of their time. And this is an example of, you know, you talk about public resentment being fueled by perks that are received by elected officials. This is a prime example of something like that, where you have people didn't even know that they were supposed to be working this minimum number of hours to get this pension. When you're talking about pension reform statewide, you're talking about something different, because the Illinois Municipal Retirement Fund is quite a bit different from the five pension systems that we usually talk about. But let me just touch on that really quickly. Right now, Senate President Cullerton has a method of pension reform that he has said for about close to 4 years now has been saying this will pass constitutional muster, which the original pension reform plan in 2013 didn't do.
Well, we've kind of lost a little bit of focus on the pensions with everything else that has been going on, haven't we?
Well, yeah, and we shouldn't, because it's still a huge crisis. But Cullerton's plan, which Governor Rauner has also signed on to, would save the state about $1 billion a year in pensions, and that is no small figure. Now, Governor Rauner has been on Cullerton because they have not introduced the bill yet to vote on. And Cullerton says, well, it's hard to pass this in an election year. So I think what you're seeing now is the two sides are using different things as leverage against each other. And I think that's where pension reform has ended up. I do think we will see this bill come up, not before the election, unfortunately, because it seems like we can't do anything difficult before the election. Because nobody wants to vote on anything that's problematic. But I do think you'll see this after the election, most likely in next spring's legislative session. And then that'll have to go through the Supreme Court, too, and we'll see if that survives.
That's Matt Dietrich. He's the editor of Reboot Illinois. I want to thank Amanda Vinicky, Illinois Public Radio State House Bureau Chief, for joining us as well. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for today. Check out www.21stshow.org for all their information. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.